FM, WBAI, and WBAI.org on the web. I'm Michael G. Haskins, and good morning, and thank you so much for tuning in. Please visit us online at WBAI.org. Consider becoming a sustaining member to this commercial-free station, a program you just heard, Global Movements, Urban Struggles. If you'd like to support that effort, talking about drumming. That's right, the drum. That's WBAI.org. If you didn't get a chance to listen entirely or make that pledge, call in and support, well, I'm sure that you'll want to stay tuned throughout the next couple of hours for Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall. That's Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall right here on Pacifica Radio WBAI. Stay tuned.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. You know, sometimes, baby, I'm so carefree. Joy that's hard to hide. And then sometimes again it seems that all I have is worry. And then you're bound to see my other side. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. Get more than my share, but that's one thing I never mean to do, 'cause I love you. Oh, baby, I'm just human. Don't you know I have faults like anyone? Sometimes I find myself alone regretting some little foolish thing, some simple thing I've done. 'Cause I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. Don't let me be misunderstood. I try so hard, so please don't let me be.
Don't let me be misunderstood. Nina Simone, this is Gloria J. Brown Marshall, and the show is Law of the Land. On this show, we not only explore the law, but we explore the humanity, the humanness that is law, the people affected by law, those people in law enforcement, all components of law. And this show is a very important one. It's very important for a number of reasons. Every week we explore a very intricate issue, examination of not just for those people in law, lawyers or judges, but also for the regular person, the listener, our listeners at WBAI, because you deserve it. And today we are exploring criminal justice, and we're exploring it from the aspect of the officer as well as those people who work in examination of the data, those people who write about this in their books and explore it from the standpoint of why we are in a situation in which we have such a divide between policing and the community. What has happened historically? What is going on today? And where are we going in the future? All of these things are important to each and every one of us. A Washington Post article not too long ago said that by the end of this year, there will be perhaps 1,000 people killed by police in this country. We're in a nation where there are over 2 million people incarcerated in our jails and prisons. We have 25% of the world's incarcerated population. We have the majority of the female incarcerated population. And yet we are only 5% of the world's population overall. What's happening? Why should the people trust? So much has taken place when it comes to Ferguson, Missouri. Of course, dear to our hearts, the Eric Garner case in Staten Island. And we know about Michael Brown in Ferguson, but we also know there are so many other cases, Walter Scott in South Carolina, so many things that have taken place around the country that have divided us. Officer friendly, someone said, is not so friendly to us anymore. So at this juncture, my college, as an associate professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, part of the City University of New York system, wonderful college. I enjoy teaching my constitutional law classes, race and the law. I enjoy being part of the gender studies program. This college, John Jay College, has embarked on a criminal justice program that focuses on that divide between police and the community. So this particular show is not only one that focuses on criminal justice, but focuses on that divide and how we can bridge that divide. And Bridging the Divide, Reimagining Police-Community Relations, is a conference, a year-long conference, that begins today. You can participate. All of the events, for the most part, unless there's something that's just part of the school activity, this year-long conference, think about that. A criminal justice conference on police in the community that lasts from this day until May 6th, with events taking place almost every month. Scholars from around New York, around the country, and some from outside of this country coming in here to discuss police and community relations, discussing how we can envision and then come up with practical components to bridge the gap between the police and the community. And we're familiar with this division. It's one that the Department of Justice has discussed in its report. We know that after the Ferguson riots, involving, of course, the reaction to the non-indictment of Darren Wilson, that we had the Department of Justice from our U.S. Attorney General's office go into Ferguson, Missouri, doing an examination and find that there were many abuses of constitutional rights, finding that there were inefficiencies, to say the least, finding that there were practices that violated the rights of the African-American community and others in the community. And that report was one that then spurred the government to go forward, the President Obama's initiative. We had reports just basically saying that there is something going on. It has become a them or us situation between the police who are supposed to protect us and the community that in many instances the police fear. Prejudices run deep on both sides, but unfortunately too often it is the community of color that suffers most. The sense that there's no justice in the justice system when it comes to whether or not the district attorney is going to actually protect the rights of the individual over the relationship, ongoing relationship with the police department. To that end, today, this evening at 6 p.m., our DA in Brooklyn, the Honorable Kenneth P. Thompson, will be giving a presentation. And this presentation is one in which he is going to discuss the role of law enforcement in ensuring justice is delivered. He is going to say in his keynote as DA, he's going to say why in many instances we should continue to trust this justice system. How we are going to trust it, because he as a DA and many other DAs, because the Brooklyn DA has been, you know, one that has been just is taking the path from one that was under a great deal of scrutiny and public mistrust based on things that had taken place under the prior administration, to a DA that will soon, DA's office that will soon be awarded in October based on the changes that have taken place there. So he is in a very keen role to tell us how law enforcement will ensure justice and ensure that justice is delivered as a DA. So tonight, 6 p.m., this is open to the public. So we want to make sure that people come out to John Jay College. This conference is online. This conference information is online for those people who want to see more, plan their year. This is free and open to the public. So if you go to the John Jay website, you will find information on this conference. For those of you who want to, it's on the front page of the John Jay College website. And that's jjay.cuny/edu. Bridging the Divide. But if you go on the website, look, you know, you'll see in the lower part on the right-hand side, you'll see the image, you'll hit the link, you'll get the information. We want you to be there to hear Kenneth P. Thompson, our Brooklyn DA, talk about ensuring justice. This is what we need to hear in order to bridge that gap. And this conference, as I said, is an ongoing one, and one in which we're going to hear more. But for today, I want to bring to you our guests. And those guests include not just the conference coordinator, Tiffany Wheatland, who will be our first guest today, but also one of our professors from John Jay College who has been studying the actions of police and has written a book. And during our 10:30 segment, Gloria's Book List, we're going to be talking with Professor Emeritus, that means that he's a retired professor from John Jay College, Dr. Eli Silverman. And then we're going to talk with law enforcement on the ground, boots on the ground, investigator Ali McBride from New Jersey will be with us at 11 o'clock, and then at 11:30, I am very proud to say that the president of John Jay College will be on the line discussing this initiative. So this is a great show. I look forward to all of our guests, what they have to offer, what it will do for you as the listener. On WBAI 99.5 FM Pacifica Radio, this is Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall. And with us to start off this show, Bridging the Divide, Reimagining Police Community Relations, is the coordinator of that conference, Tiffany Wheatland. Hello, Tiffany.
Hello. Good morning, Gloria.
How are you today? Thank you so much for joining us. And I'm so excited to have you here because this job that you have, a year-long conference, I am sure it involves so many moving parts that taking time out to be on the show is something that we really appreciate.
Thank you. Gloria, thank you so much for having me. We appreciate the opportunity to raise the profile of this initiative on your program. So thank you.
Well, let's look at this conference, and you are the conference coordinator, yes?
You could say that, but I should acknowledge early on that there has been an entire committee designed to sort of put together and help coordinate this year-long of events, and obviously led by Dr. Carlton Jama Adams. We've been able to put quite a feat together, so yes.
It is, and in a very diverse program it is, and in looking at the many parts to it, it begins tonight with the launch, I would say the launch event at the mm-hmm. Lloyd Seeley Library, the Lloyd Seeley Lecture, and this is an annual lecture, and Lloyd Seeley, of course, was a police officer, African-American police officer who rose to the highest ranks during the 1960s. He was known as the gentleman, the giant, the gentle giant, the intellectual who then went on to become
a professor at John Jay College after he retired from the New York Police Department. And, you know, his name is the one on our library. And to have the DA, Thompson, from Brooklyn, as the Lloyd Seeley lecturer for this evening, 6 p.m. at John Jay College, is quite a feat.
That's right. That's right. And we are very grateful to the Brooklyn District Attorney's Office for agreeing to come and participate in this event, and obviously to help sort of set the tone for the programming to come. So we're really excited to host them tonight.
Wonderful. Wonderful. And so tonight, this event is open to the public, free and open to the public. You can see your DA in Brooklyn, or if you're not a resident of Brooklyn, you can see this DA who's made such great strides in the area of criminal justice. And beyond this, not only, many people go to these programs and they see a speech, but this isn't just a speech. How is this program a little different?
So what we're hoping, and I think you're referring to the program overall, yes?
Well, the program tonight with the DA, because it's not just a speech. He's given a keynote address, but there's also
That's right.
a moderator. And the moderator, Gregory Thomas, is the first national president of the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives, or NOBLE. And I've had the opportunity to actually address an audience of membership from NOBLE. Look forward to doing that again in the future. So these are black law enforcement officers who are actually not just in the community, but of the community and attempting to protect the community. So many times we look at this whole community policing divide, and we see this them or us, but we have to realize that those people in law enforcement are of our communities.
Absolutely.
And I think that's part of what we will gain as audience members in attending this conference. You're helping to coordinate, because when one goes to the website and they actually click on the link and they see this list of such a variety of programs, that, you know, it's really something for everyone here who has an interest in justice, wherever you may be, from the youth to the elders to those in law enforcement, those affected by law enforcement. Let's just go through a few of the programs. And I know your time is tight, but I just want people to understand mm-hmm. what you're doing here and what we have in John Jay College, what people in New York and the tri-state areas can really partake in if they just take the time. And I know there are many people who are thinking that, you know, this issue can never be resolved. But we're taking one step forward, and to participate, to have community in a conference on police community relations is mm-hmm. vital. And it's one of the reasons why I think it's important for us to do this show today. So let's look at one of the programs. For example, we have one coming up on October 5th, correct?
Correct.
Okay, tell us a little bit about that one.
So this panel is entitled Understanding Police Subjectivities, and really it's looking at understanding the psychology of policing. So we'll have a few commentators, Andrew Costello, who is Deputy Inspector of Police with the NYPD. We'll have our very own Herbert Johnson, who's adjunct professor here within our Department of Africana Studies. The panel will also feature Sophine Charles, who, as some of you may know, is founder and CEO of Our Kids. She also happens to be the former NYPD officer and liaison of the Vera Institute of Justice. And then Matthew Pogg has kindly agreed to join us as well. Matthew is former Chief Deputy U.S. Marshal and is currently serving as the National VP-elect for Blacks in Government, or BIG. And so this panel will be moderated by Dr. Carlton Jama Adams, who, again, is chair of our department, and we expect for it to be a really critical discussion about what it means to be a police officer, some of the challenges that they face. And so we're excited to have this be our opening forum on police perspective.
So that is October 5th at 1:30 mm-hmm. to 4 on the college campus, John Jay College, 59th and 10th Avenue, accessible by, you know, bus, accessible from Columbus Circle if you're taking the train. This initiative to have this conference, as I said, is something that has so many different aspects to it, and the wealth of knowledge on this panel is formidable. And to be able to have these people with different perspectives, but the core being law enforcement, to present their viewpoint to a community audience, in an audience made up of scholars, made up of those people in academia, as well as the regular person. So anyone is available to enter and sit down and listen to this information. And one thing that I'm noted for, hopefully, is accessibility of knowledge. I use this example. It's like having a library with all the greatest books from around the world, but the door is locked. And that happens too often. Yeah, it happens too often in academia. Mm-hmm. You have all this knowledge, a wealth of knowledge, but there's no access to it. So a conference like this is very important to me, and I hope it's important to our community when we think about what's available for you to access here in New York City. And now let's move over to November 11th. Now, November 11th is another panel, and I'm not even going through all of them. I'm just jumping around just to show the wealth of diversity here. So let's touch on this panel. Now, this panel, November 11th, tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, so this is going to be one of the panels that focuses on community perspectives. It's entitled Defining and Conceptualizing Challenges and Opportunities for At-Risk Communities. We're going to have some featured speakers here. Bud Stouth, again, from our very own John Jay College. He's within the Department of Psychology, and enjoyed the appointment, actually, with Gender Studies as well. Susan Herman has kindly agreed to join us. She is Deputy Commissioner of Collaborative Policing with NYPD. And so it will be really crucial, really important to have that voice featured on this panel. Juan Rivera serves as Program Director for Bronx Works, which is a homeless outreach organization that focuses on supporting homeless. We'll be there, and then, of course, it'll be moderated by Dr. Adams. This panel is really focused on trying to focus and highlight the challenges, as the title states, which are faced by communities of color, minority communities, communities which tend to be marginalized. And we're hoping that we have represented a diversity of perspectives. This is our goal. People from various disciplines, various backgrounds that will come together and speak about some of the issues that are really facing the community today.
Yes, and we have, thank you, panels on youth and policing. We have panels on policing in vulnerable youth, as well as the general youth. We have even have panels on policing mentally ill and homeless populations. I want us to understand that there is an aspect to policing, I think, that many of us in the community don't quite understand, and we might not ever understand because we're not in the shoes of the officer who has any number of people walking into his or her life at any moment. I had a chance to speak to an officer last night when I was just getting a cup of coffee. It was late. I'd worked late in the office. And I just stopped and just talked to the officer about Miranda rights. And I just decided to ask him, you know, when do you actually, you know, in practical terms, you as an officer, when do you render Miranda rights? When do you do certain things? And he said this, one of the misconceptions is there's so much on television that tells people what an officer should or should not do, that when an officer interacts with someone in the community, they already have their mind made up how they should be treated. It could be a poor idea of what the officer is bringing to the table, or one that's very rich, or one that's comes from an education at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, or it could be this idea that an officer is supposed to do what the officer did on television. These officers have to interact with people who have all these different mindsets at the time. And then all these different languages, all the backgrounds, everyone is coming, especially in New York City, coming to this officer, and the officer then has to navigate all of that. And that's why the subjectivity of it becomes one in which what a person as an officer representing the government is bringing to that interaction becomes pivotal when it rises to the level when violence is part of that interaction, when the need for force is part of that interaction, and then the overlapping ideas of when was force necessary, was that unreasonable force, Did the officer act appropriately? What was the intent of the civilian? All that comes into play. And so we have to kind of unlayer all of those layers that are part of that officer-community relationship. And I think this conference will allow people to see those different layers. There's a panel on women in policing. Policing of religious communities. Now, that's very interesting. That's in March. And this, remember, this is a year-long conference, Bridging the Divide, Reimagining Police Community Relations, a conference that launches tonight with a talk by our keynote speaker, the Honorable Kenneth P. Thompson, Brooklyn District Attorney, who's going to be talking about the role of law enforcement in ensuring justice is delivered. That is to be moderated by Gregory Thompson of NOBLE, the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives, tonight at John Jay College, 59th and 10th Avenue. And this is the Lloyd Seeley Lecture. And I'm on the line with Tiffany Wheatland, a professor in the Africana Studies Department, who is helping to coordinate this conference, year-long conference. It ends in May. Let's talk about one more panel. I know you're busy, but I want to just talk about one more panel, and that's the March panel on policing of religious community groups.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So this one, and I should clarify that we have a full raft of activities taking place in the spring. As Gloria just mentioned, for the listeners, we will have a full spring schedule coming out shortly, so please stay tuned for that. You can check the website for details there. This particular panel, Policing of Religious Community Groups, will hopefully feature a diversity of perspectives on issues of religious marginalization, so groups that experience either exploitation or some sort of level of marginalization due in particular to their religious affiliation. We know that our very own Maria Volpe, who is professor within the Department of Sociology and happens to be director of dispute resolutions program here at John Jay, and also of the Dispute Resolution Center at CUNY, she will be serving as moderator for this panel. It is scheduled to take place on March 16th. The panelists will be confirmed shortly, but again, we would like for people to stay tuned and be on the lookout for the marketing of the spring program. We are very, very excited and looking forward to having a slew of important conversations in the spring. It will end, obviously, with a conference that happens on May 6th, through 6th, and it will be capped off by a fantastic presentation by Dr. Lenora Polani, and we'll come to that.
And, of course, that spring conference in during Black History Month, February 3rd, we will be discussing race and policing. That is a pivotal aspect of the mistrust and the divide between the police and the community has been this issue of race. And as someone who has researched race and the law, someone who teaches this issue to students from different backgrounds and teaching the issue of not just race, but racism, its impact on us individually, institutionalized racism. And in my book, Race, Law, and American Society, I go through not just what is happening today, but what has been the foundation that gets us to where we are now. So this panel on race and policing in February will be pivotal as well. A year-long panel, Bridging the Divide, Reimagining Police Community Relations, the launch tonight with the keynote address by D.A. Thompson from Brooklyn. And on the phone today, we have Tiffany Wheatland, the first guest, and a program that will provide the listeners with so much information who will, I am sure these listeners will not only want to participate in at least one of the events that you are coordinating, but they will feel they will have to tell others. A year-long event such as this is rare. It's in your city, your community, and Professor Tiffany Wheatland is working so hard to make it the best conference it can be to help us all move forward so that we can bridge that divide between police-community relations. I thank you so much, Professor Tiffany Wheatland, and I wish you much luck and success, and look forward to all of the events that are taking place between today and May 6th.
Gloria, thank you so much for having me. And just one last note, please let your listeners know that they can follow the conversation as well via social media on Twitter at BridgingTheDivideJJ. And we hope that they will be inclined to come and participate in all of the activities that they are able to. Thanks for having me.
And one more time, give us that. They can follow it on social media.
Yes, on Twitter, the hashtag is BridgingTheDivideJJ, the letters JJ. And that all of that information has been featured on the website, which they can find. They can link, actually, to the Bridging website from the John Jay homepage.
From the John Jay homepage. I thank you again, Tiffany Wheatland, and look forward to participating on a couple of these panels myself. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you.
And so thank you so much, Tiffany. Our next guest will be coming up right after this musical break. This is Gloria J. Brown Marshall, Law of the Land, 99.5 FM, WBAI. Sketches of Spain, arranged and conducted by Gil Evans. Just what we needed. on this day discussing criminal justice, we need to be able to open our minds and our spirits to new ideas. And we're going to be presented with new ideas. We're going to have an analysis and examination of where we are in this country when it comes to policing our communities. Today, there's a launch of a new initiative, and that is an initiative that will be taking place at John Jay College. The conference, a year-long conference beginning this evening with the District Attorney Thompson's launching of his ideas. Role of law enforcement and ensuring justice is delivered. He's going to be telling us from the DA's perspective, helping us to bridge the divide. And bridging that divide is what this conference is about, a conference that begins today, this evening, with that keynote address and continues, you know, almost every month from today to May 6th. And part of this bridging the divide, part of understanding how we got ourselves into this, and I have to say, mess. How did we get ourselves into a situation in which we have so many lives lost, we have such animosity between police and the community, and we are in need of experts, and we have one today on the line. We have an expert who is also, I can say, a friend as well as a former colleague, and that is Dr. Eli Silverman. Dr. Silverman is not just someone who has worked with these issues as an academic. He's an expert in the area. This is one of several books and research projects that he's done in examining the numbers. Because that's the thing, you have these statistics, but you have to have someone who can look at these numbers, gather them, and tell us what they mean, tell us what is going on. And Dr. Eli Silverman, Professor Emeritus, John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He has previously served with the U.S. Department of Justice and the National Academy of Public Administration in Washington, D.C. He was a visiting exchange professor at the Police Staff College in Bramshill, England, and we share that distinction. I also served in Bramshill as an exchange scholar. He has lectured, consulted with, and trained numerous agencies in the United States, United Kingdom, Canada, Mexico, Europe, Asia, Australia. He's here to share his knowledge with us. This segment of the show, you know, is called Glorious Book List. And it's during this segment that we discuss an author's work. We're going to discuss Dr. Silverman's book, The Crime Numbers Game, Management by Manipulation. Welcome, Dr. Silverman.
Thank you very much.
And today we have time to actually drill down into some of this information. You know that this show is part of the launch of the John Jay College's conference on criminal justice, this issue of bridging the divide between police and community. But you have been discussing and you've, you know, talked to, and I've had a chance to watch, and there are people who want to, if you want to watch some of the lectures that Professor Silverman has given or interviews, they're online on YouTube. You can, you know, see more and hear more about what he has to offer as far as his perspective on how did we get into, and I called it a mess, and I know that's the vernacular, but how did we get to a point where we have these tensions? What was going on in policing?
Well, from I think one important component of it, in that which my co-author and I, Dr. John Eterno, have been looking into for many years, it was the advent, in 1994, of what we call the performance culture. That is a heavy emphasis on assessing and judging the performance of police officers by numbers. And just the numbers per se, the quantity, not the quality. This began with a management system called CompStat, which holds commanders accountability for crime and conditions in their precincts, which makes a lot of sense. But what happened in the 90s And through really 2012, particularly 2001 to 2012, is that system was turned on its head and it became upside down. So there was an incentive. If you wanted to be promoted, if you wanted to be advanced, if you wanted to be in a favorable precinct that was near your home or whatever, you had to produce the numbers. And so the incentive was to distort the numbers and have quantity. Now, you talk about bridging the gap. Part of that gap is a result of this intense pressure from upper level in the years I mentioned to come up with numbers. So not only did you have to have favorable crime statistics, which meant a lot of distortion and manipulation of the crime numbers, which I can talk about, but there was also immense pressure to have increased summonses, stop and frisk, and arrests. And as you well know, the pressure escalated so that there were many cases of indiscriminate stop and frisk, arrests, and summonses, and many of them were not based on rational ground. And so they would go into precincts, particularly precincts of color, and come up with the numbers. And just to come up with the numbers, it led to what Judge Shindlin said in the federal court in 2013, which she described as indirect racial profiling. And so the pressure was so intense that people were stopped, arrested, or summonses, and it further divided community and police during that period.
And going back to that case, or one of the three cases that Judge Shindlin presided over, we had the Floyd case, which was the more recent of the cases,
right?
And the Floyd versus New York Police Department, and you testified in that case, right?
Yes, the judge in her decision cited two of our articles on this topic, because we did two separate surveys on this, which is the basis for our findings. And I testified, and we testified on, we did two surveys in 2008 and 2012 of retired police officers. The first one in 2008 was of captains and above, captains and higher, the upper management ranks. But in 2012, we had retired of all rank, and almost 4,000 retirees, and almost just about 48% return rate of those that we surveyed, which is in social science research, is considered quite excellent in terms of percentage return. And this clearly demonstrated that. And this is one of the things that the judge cited in her decision, that the pressure escalated, and this was particularly on stop and frisk that she was, that this case centered around. But it went, the pressure, the high pressure, we measured pressure in terms of low, medium, high. The high pressure of that retired officers reported quadrupled from 2002 to 2012 as to the earlier period, the first period. So she cited that. And at the same time, she cited another finding. And then we asked, what was the pressure to obey legal and constitutional rules? And that was the only pressure that declined. In other words, as the pressure to go up, to increase summonses, decrease arrests, and increase stop and frisk, there was less pressure to obey legal constitutional rules. And that showed what the priorities of the department were in terms of, it may not have been articulated or explicitly put out that way, but that's how officers read it. They read it because they saw rewards going to the pressure to increase arrest, summons, and stop and frisk. So she cited that, among other things, and we were gratified that she cited that in her very lengthy and very exhaustive, in my opinion, an incredibly well-written document.
And we know that there were controversies after that decision, and we were presented as a community, a New York community, with this question of whether or not the judge was biased. That was very controversial at the time. The result was that that there was no bias found, but these cases were cases in which she did handle them in a way in which it was felt that she should not have received all of the cases. As far as bias, that was not found.
Right.
There was an appeal that was by certain police officer groups. And then, of course, this was such a deep-seated conflict that it played a major role in the changing of the administration, so that those people who were more in line with the Bloomberg administration, and Bloomberg being this person who was into a lot of the quantitative and number crunching and proponent of this quota-based system, and those people who were in line with Bloomberg were not those who were deemed favorable in the political viewpoint of the civilian population. Uh-huh. And so we have now Mayor de Blasio, who ran on this issue of this abuse of stop and frisk, the abuse of the policing of particular communities that actually would be seen as more vulnerable, and therefore the quota could be satisfied by stopping, as a matter of fact, stopping and frisking those young people, people of color, and poor people, even though the state attorney general's report on this found that if they were looking for guns, that it was more often they didn't find it, and that when they did find guns, and even in the smaller percentage of people of who were white who were stopped, they found more guns on them than they did on people of color. And that's a report that people can read on the website for the U.S. Attorney General's office. I mean, the New York Attorney General's office.
Yeah, that's a good point. The opponents of her decision just repeated the same thing. They attacked her. They attacked the basis of her decision. I mean, I know that well, because when our first study came out, we were attacked. We were attacked by the press editorials in the Post and the News by name, because the study did get a considerable amount of publicity. And so the mayor and the police department opposed her decision. They went to appeal it, as you say, and then the union came in and said they wanted to appeal it. And rather than really serving the interest, in my opinion, of their members, because the interesting thing of this is that most police officers don't like doing this. It's not that they go out and want to be discriminatory. That's my opinion. This system would incentivize them, push them in a certain direction. It's very interesting. The former Commissioner Ray Kelly came out with his book, and he was asked again about the stop and frisk. And in one interview I heard him, and he said, well, we have a very diverse police department. How can you say that we have such a diverse police department, racially, ethnically, religiously, from different countries, that they would be prejudiced and discriminatory? Well, that's not the issue. The issue is not the, in my opinion, now, of course, there are some officers who are, but me, to my mind, the major issue is how the system generates from the top and is thrust down on the lower levels, and that's what was found. So the city and the union opposed it, and as you said, then Mayor de Blasio made this a key signature item in his campaign. And in fact, the number have substantially gone down now. And there are reforms that are emanating from this, but many of these reforms that are beginning now really stem from the judge's decision, because she had a opinion, and she had a remedial opinion which stated certain reforms had to be instituted. And we're beginning to see these come out now. And the city council passed an inspector general. There is now an oversight group. So there is more oversight. It remains to be seen what will emerge from this and how significant. But the key, in our view, always has been transparency. And you have to have a department that is transparent and that makes these numbers available. And yes, data is important, but they have to be meaningful data, and they have to be substantiated, and they have to be examined. And no, I know no organization that's going to put out information that's detrimental to its cause. So by and large, an organization will say, look how well we're doing. You ask them, who made that decision? Oh, well, the data shows it. Well, who generates that data? So, you know, for years, the police department wasn't even revealing misdemeanor crimes when Commissioner Kelly came in. It was only two of over 500 police departments in the state of New York that didn't communicate to the State Division of Criminal Justice Services. It's misdemeanor crimes. Now, why is that important? Because if you don't reveal, then you can be pushing many of the felony, that's crimes, the major crimes, into the misdemeanor category, and that's what was being done, and the public would not know about it. So it's not only the data, but what data? How inclusive is it? How are people able to review it? And for many years, the department has resisted this, and only now is beginning to open up. And it should be a very interesting period of time to see to what extent these reforms take place. Just the other day, the police department announced a new program where the police officers will give a citizen a report if they were stopped and there was no crime, why they were stopped, in their name. And I saw where the union has come out against it. More paperwork, rather than using it as an example of showing where there is legitimacy to what police do, and that there's an openness and a willingness to communicate with the citizenry, and there's a right to know of the citizen. They have a right to know. If you're stopped, you have a right to know why you're stopped. You know, it may be a good reason to stop the person, but shouldn't you have the right to know? So these are very important questions.
And we are talking with Dr. Eli Silverman on Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall, WBAI 99.5 FM. The Crime Numbers Game is his book, The Crime Numbers Game, Management by Manipulation. In this book, he brings together the work of, we see two of the criminologists, one a former NYPD captain, and they present the first in-depth empirical analysis of this management system, exposing the truth about crime statistics, manipulation in the NYPD, and the repercussions suffered by crime victims and those who blew the whistle on these corrupt practices. Now, you're giving this insider insight into a shrouded kind of brother or sisterhood, because many of us are familiar with this wall of blue, or I'm not black, I'm not white, I'm blue. So we're on the outside looking in, and I think, you know, we're talking about bridging the divide. How do we bridge the divide when we're seen as the other and sometimes live in fear of the police department? And maybe they want us to live in fear of them. We're not sure because of the secrecy. And you were talking about transparency that's necessary. Are people in policing afraid that, you know, if they reveal the secrets behind the blue shroud, that we won't respect them as much, or we won't be as fearful? What is with the secrecy?
Well, One key test that I see coming up is, a number of years ago, there was a police officer whose name is Adrian Schoolcraft, who felt there was this pressure and went to his commander and tried to report this pressure, which he thought was unreasonable and inappropriate.
And the pressure to have those summonses, have those arrests,
right,
in order to gain the type of hours that were more conducive to a good schedule, try to get that vacation time in order to please the higher-ups.
That's
I'm
right.
going to go out there and stop people who may not need to be stopped, and without the sense of their constitutional protections, but more the sense of, I need these quota points.
That's right, and not only that, he taped, he had a secret tape recorder during roll calls on this, which were then publicized in the press. And to make a long story short, he, and this is a subject of a court case that has been going on for a long time, and it's supposed to finally come to trial in a month or two. And he, on an October, or Halloween 2012, I believe, he left work and said he was sick, and there was controversy of whether or not he was really sick, but he was under a great deal of pressure because he went to the upper levels and nothing happened, and the precinct knew about it. He went home. They entered his home against his will, his apartment, and against his will, said, you must go back to work. He said, no, I don't feel well. And to make a long story short, they forcibly took him to Jamaica Hospital psychiatric ward, and he was compelled to stay there 6 days against his will. No one knew about it, and this subject of a very controversial court case. So my answer to you is, a part of it is, we need to know, are you going to make it difficult for whistleblowers, for the people who want to say this is wrong? And there are many examples of whistleblowers
within the police department.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Within the police department, who say this is morally and legally and ethically wrong. And the question is, how are they going to be treated? And I know we were talking to police officers a few years ago. We would get phone calls and say, you know, this is wrong. We should do something about it. I said, well, I can connect you with certain people from the press. And they would say, oh, no, I can't do that. I can't do that. I don't want to be schoolcrafted. So it became a verb, like, in other words, his name was Adrian Schoolcraft. They didn't want the same thing to happen to them. You know, they have families. They don't want... And Schoolcraft has lost his job, his pension, everything, and he's quite living somewhere upstate. So it's very, very difficult. So I think one of the things to look for is, how is the department in this period, after 2012, going to reward the good guys? The guys who say, you know, who come out and say, you know, this is just inappropriate and this is wrong. And if the public can see that, you ask about the public, if the public could see that the department, I think there's some sign of it now, willing to say, yes, we're like anyone else. We have warts. We have things we need to address. If the public can observe that, then the public will have more confidence, and you'll have greater trust. Because the bottom line is, without trust between the police and the public, it not only serves the public, it serves the police. When you have someone who's trustful, I remember being in a precinct once, and this woman, and this was in a black neighborhood, she came in, and she was in the area, and she says, you know, I can't, it's a long ride. She knew these particular community police officers, which were more then than now, although they're trying to restore this. That's another thing to look at, see how this restoration takes place. And she said, I need to, can you give me a ride home? And these two officers say, oh, sure, it's a long walk. So I would say she was middle-aged, elderly woman. But on the way back, and I was with him, and then I sat in the back, and the way back, she's pointing out to the officers, here's a drug place, this is a drug place, and this is a drug place. So it serves the police as well as the public. And ultimately, the police are dependent upon information. And if you don't have trust from the public, you're not going to receive that information. And the greater the trust, the greater level of information. Information is key.
Information is key. And we are here talking with Dr. Eli Silverman on Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall, discussing Bridging the Divide, Reimagining Police-Community Relations. I thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Silverman, my friend, my former colleague, and someone who is doing such great work. His book with John Eterno is one I hope that you will go out and get. It's a necessary one for us to understand these things. We need to read. We need to understand. Here is a person who's an expert in data collection, who's examined the data, can present it to you in a way that you can understand. The title of the book is The Crime Numbers Game: Management by Manipulation. I thank you, and I look forward to your participation in this conference upcoming at John Jay College, and we will find out more about the numbers game and how these manipulations are affecting police departments and whether or not we can regain the trust that's been lost because of it. Thank you again.
Well, thank you so much, and I enjoyed it, and please keep up your good work.
Thank you.
Steiner, Ron Carter, Jack DeJohnette on guitars, Bill Frisell on guitar. This is the first time McCoy Tyner worked with guitar, this guitar trio, and it's just been amazing to hear this wonderful morning program. We need this. It cleanses our spirit. It keeps us creative. And I truly believe that activists should be creative. Academics should be creative. We should look at the creative process, and that artists should also be more in line with activism when they have the opportunity. We all have a role to play in making this country, making this world a better place. You have some role to play. Be a weekend warrior. Take that knowledge, wherever it may lie, in academia, in a vocational area, in education, wherever it may be. Take it and use it to make your community better. That's what I try to do as one of these lost people from the time period in which those in law actually went into the community to help educate. This is outreach. This is what I'm doing as part of Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall. I am actually trying to do outreach around law. Law of the Land is a program on WBAI 99.5 FM, Pacifica Radio, geared to helping us better understand law, law enforcement, application of law, those affected by the law, all aspects of law. Next week, we begin the first term, 2015 term of the U.S. Supreme Court begins on Monday. We will begin with so many cases. I'll, of course, give you the insights the court when possible, insights about the court, as well as those cases. The U.S. Supreme Court is a co-equal branch of power. We know about Congress. We watch it constantly. We know about our president. We watch him and his family constantly, or it might be we watch her and her family constantly. But do we know about the U.S. Supreme Court? Are we following these nine justices? Do we understand their relevance, their importance, and their role in our lives? That's what I do with my program, Law of the Land. We need you to support programs like this. WBAI is a program that's listener supported. So if you want to support Law of the Land, please do so. I appreciate it. If you have a question for me, please send it to G.B. Marshall, Marshall with two L's, G.B. Marshall at WBAI.org. gbmarshall@wbai.org, or you can follow me on Twitter if you'd like, and that's G Brown Marshall, Brown with an E, Marshall with two L's. That's my hashtag, G Brown Marshall. Follow me on Twitter, send me an email, gbmarshall@wbai.org, and of course, listen on Tuesdays from 10 to 12. Law of the Land is here for you. Today's program in particular, Bridging the Divide, Reimagining Police-Community Relations. Today, tonight, 6 o'clock, we will have D.A. Thompson, our Brooklyn D.A., speaking at John Jay College. It's open to the public. And he's speaking about how his office is helping to bridge that divide. We need to know. The reality is, having heard Professor Eli Silverman discuss the numbers, The data shows that those even in policing who have retired from policing are affected by this push to stop and frisk people who may or may not have done anything just in order to get the quota. And this is left over from the prior administration. The prior administration did many good things. I don't like the bicycle lanes, but that's another show. I don't like taking away the parking. That's another program. But one thing that has been at the core of the controversy that has really caused and exacerbated the divide between police and the community was stop and frisk. And the program on stop and frisk will be December 1st. And that's part of the Bridging the Divide conference, a year-long conference starting this evening with the launch by D.A. Thompson, with his Lloyd Seeley lecture. As we said, Lloyd Seeley was a prominent African-American police officer and John Jay Professor. This year-long conference ends in May, the 5th or 6th. Almost every month there is a program. And in December, policing, a review of broken windows and stop and frisk. That's December 1st at John Jay College, and this is open to the public. And there is going to be an analysis of broken windows, which is, of course, and in very quick summary, when a window is broken or there's some small infraction of the law, it is a symbol of coming worsening conditions, coming trouble in crime for that particular neighborhood. And so it's this broken windows theory that now is under some scrutiny, and some people believe that there's no such thing as broken windows. Others rely on it and believe that policing using the broken windows theory is important for all communities to prevent future crime. But we had someone, Eli Silverman, Dr. Silverman, talk about the data he collected from police officers and those who retired from policing. We actually have someone in law enforcement presently, boots on the ground law enforcement, with us as well. He is going to be one of the presenters in this conference, Bridging the Divide. His name is Investigator McBride. And Investigator McBride is an officer, as I said, on the ground, who is working hard to keep the New Jersey community safe. He is someone who has seen a great deal and yet has worked very hard to maintain his humanity, to understand that balance between law enforcement and the community. And he brings a particular perspective, not just one from the law enforcement standpoint. As an investigator, the fugitive, in his job entails the search for fugitives. He's part of the New Jersey Department of Corrections. And Investigator McBride is here with us to discuss policing from the police officer's standpoint. Welcome.
Good morning, Gloria. Good morning to all your listeners as well.
And thank you so much for joining us. And one of the things that I'd like to say is, in our program, we try to give the different perspectives. And so far, this show has given us the perspective as an expert analyzes the data, but you're on the ground. You are boots on the ground. And
yes, ma'am, I am. I've been in law enforcement for the past 20 years. I actually started off as a corrections officer at Northern State Prison. And I moved on to investigations, and that was statewide, but specifically at East Jersey State Prison. And then I worked, then left there, and then I worked for the U.S. Marshals Fugitive Task Force, and that has actually been close to 10 years of doing that job.
And the U.S. Marshals Fugitive Task Force means that you're searching for those people who have either committed crimes or accused of committed crimes and have decided that they're not going to stand trial for the punishment.
Absolutely. They've already been charged. It's just a matter of them coming back to face whatever sanctions they will receive because they are fugitives, failed to report to court, maybe even escaped from one of the prison facilities in the state. So that's who we usually go after. It's easy. You know, it's easy to a degree when you're law enforcement and whomever you're going after is already wanted, as opposed to getting into a situation where you have to make a determination as to whether you're going to move forward or whether you're going to escalate or de-escalate a situation. You know, the guys we go after, they're already wanted. So you have to deal with apprehending that individual and also dealing with the fact that you have to also maintain keeping the community safe and keeping the citizens in the community safe during that apprehension or during that investigation leading to the apprehension of that fugitive.
So then how do you walk this tightrope between realizing that apprehending this fugitive is keeping the community safe and at the same time dealing with a community who may be protecting that fugitive in many instances? Or they don't understand this role that you have, that you're actually helping the situation as opposed to someone who's trying to undermine the community or look at the community as the enemy.
Right. I think that a lot of times it has to do with approach. I think we talked about that even before on this very station. The fact that when when you're going after an individual, that individual may have probably for the most part was a part of that community. You understand? And I think that in your approach, in you communicating with that community, in you communicating with that fugitive, possibly their family, you know, their friends, people that may know them, that can lead to a safe apprehension. Because at the end of the day, most officers approach doing that with the hopefulness that the individual that they're going to apprehend, it gets to a situation where you get him, you know, you take him back without incident. That's what we want for the most part. Sometimes that doesn't happen. But I think that the more that you communicate and the more information, I heard the last speaker emphasize information, and he is so right. The more information that you have gathered makes your job easier when it comes to the apprehension of these individuals.
And so the community communication, how does that work for you? What do you do?
Well, sometimes, for instance, you may have an individual that you might go after who might just be a pariah to the community. You know, I'm from the community, and I know you talked about walking that tightrope, and I have a different perspective sometimes. You know, I'm born and raised in Newark. I went to several high schools in Newark. You know, things could have turned out differently for me. So there's a degree of compassion that I do have most of the times when I do my job. So when you go after this individual, you want to kind of consider the reason why they may have left, or the reason why they may have not turned up in court. You know, I never forget, it was a situation where an individual's daughter was assaulted. So, you know, he stayed out, and, you know, it was a possibility that he may have been looking for some type of revenge. That wasn't necessarily the case, but we had to take precautions to make sure that that wasn't the case. So, you know, again, it was about that. It was about the information that I was able to gather, talking to friends, talking to family, to make that a safe apprehension, or even a safe surrender.
Well, then this motivates me to ask a question, and this question is one that's been asked of officers and other people in city government and government generally. When it comes to policing, do you think it's important for that officer to have a relationship, a prior relationship with that particular community?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'll give you one instance. Just this morning on the front page of the New York Post, there's a picture of David Letterman on the front page. Right. But what's different about this picture of David Letterman has this long beard. He doesn't have the suit on that you're used to seeing David Letterman with on. And I'm not even sure if he has his horn-rimmed glasses on, but I know that he has a beard. He's bearded out. He just looks like an average Joe to me. But the caption over that news article says that David Letterman bumming out. So they already pretty much placed a label on how he looked. He looked like a bum, which I don't think that he necessarily looked like a bum. But their definition of who he was, they said that he was bumming out. Now, we all know who David Letterman is. We all know that David Letterman is worth millions of dollars and that he's probably lounging out in his retirement phase. That goes on in our community. So if the majority of law enforcement sees it the same way the New York Post sees that, then how do we expect them to see the average person in Newark, New Jersey, or Irvington, or East Orange, or Brooklyn? So that's why it's essential sometimes to have somebody from that community, and even sometimes that gets lost in translation. But you're better off having someone that knows that community, that know the people, that know that in Philadelphia that it's common for individuals to grow beards. You know, some call it a sunnah. You know, in Islam, you know, they sometimes assume that individuals that have these beards are practicing Muslim. That's not always the case, because it's a fashion statement, you know, and some places to wear your pants a certain way. And I'm not just talking about sagging. I'm talking about with the pants leg up or skinny jeans. Some of those things are clothing or signs of an individual that may possibly be a sophomore in college. You know, but a lot of times that comes from the information that those individuals that work in that community know of. I mean, I've worked with people who were green. They were green, and they had no clue as to who was who. And that's why it's essential to have someone that understands that community, that everybody that looks a certain way or that fits a certain prototype from what you've been exposed to constantly on television and media, it may not be who you think they are.
And the other thing, I just want to ask, because too often when you say that an officer is green and getting into the community that is one that that officer is unfamiliar, in which the officer is unfamiliar, how does an officer learn the community? What must an officer do if, you know, they're coming into it and they don't know this environment is one in which people hang out a certain place or they speak a certain way? And I always like to give the example of when school is out and you get on the bus or the subway and then 20 kids get on and they're screaming and hollering and they're trying out new curse words and all of this is going on. And if you're stepping into that, you would actually think from all the squeals and shouts and everything else that something is going on, when it's actually children at the end of a school day letting off energy from being in class this whole time. So coming into any environment, it can be seen in different ways. And I'll give another example. There was an example given of two white males standing behind two black males with a gun. And the idea was, oh, they must be arresting them. And then right. If you turn it around, it's like if you have two black males standing behind two white males and the two black males have the gun, oh, they must be holding them up.
Right. You know, with a situation like that, and that's one thing that a lot of times we miss, that law enforcement is not going to be the answer all the time. Matter of fact, it may not be the answer most of the times, because people come into this thing with preconceived notions about how they feel about a community. People bring their political baggage and their political ideologies into the job. They may already have a perspective on a community. So even if, you know, you happen to see a situation that involves two working families or two working individuals, a lot of times they can't let go of that because an individual lives in a certain community. You know, so what's starting to happen, and which is a positive, is that more law enforcement more individuals that are going into law enforcement are college graduates. Some even have gone on and gotten graduate degrees. That doesn't necessarily mean that they'll know, but at least they'll be able to make a better determination and kind of put certain things to the side before making a determination when they're going into these communities. You know, because that's the reality of it. That's the reality of it, because we think that more training is going to get it. And that's not necessarily the case. You can have all the training in the world, but if somebody comes in and they feel like, hey, man, all these individuals in this community are the same, you're going to get the same outcome. You're going to get the same outcome. So,
well, then in bridging the divide, in trying to reach these particular officers, is it that some people with this mindset shouldn't be officers in the first place?
Absolutely. I definitely agree with that. I also agree with this. For instance, just one instance, I think that African Americans, for instance, if they're in a certain community, why not? And this is where the problem lies too. Why not hip that individual that you work with? Why not hip that investigator? Why not hip that officer if something is right or if something is wrong when you're going into, and you can do that without, you know, left or right leanings. You know, reality is just reality. But the reality is that many of us, we want to go along to get along. We engage in what people call groupthink. So we don't want to seem like the oddball out, so we don't say anything. And we have to be more brave. We have to be more brave, not only for us and the community that we're in, but quite possibly for that officer that may be getting into a situation where he's going to wind up, on the 6 o'clock news.
And that's something also. That's something. I'm glad you mentioned that, because that is something also that Dr. Eli Silverman mentioned, that the whistleblower, the person who's within the ranks of policing, who sees something wrong, and of course many of us know there's internal affairs, but there is also personal affairs, and personal affairs.
There you go. That's right.
Will be that nudge. Where do you go? Because this is the thing. With any group, you know who the bad apple is. And across the country, we have these rogue police officers. We have these rogue people within the precincts who kind of take over the precinct. And it's like becomes this, you know, notorious thing where we're going to do things a certain way until, as you said, it ends up on the news because something horrible happens. And so seeing that grow and knowing it grows, do you think that starts at the top? Or does it start with that interaction on a lateral move?
It can start a lot of places. You know, some people, like you always hear the notion, oh, he's a great test taker. You know, and that great test taker may not be suitable to hold a position, you know, in administration or hold a supervisory position. So, you know, again, it goes back to those that are already in that system saying something. See, I'm going to tell you, that's one of the biggest problems. We keep skirting around it, but the reality is that you have to let these individuals know, listen, knock it off. And mind you, this can even be beyond whistleblowing. Like, if you're whistleblowing and you have to, you know, you just got to do what you got to do. But on the flip side, why not pull an individual's coat? You need to pull an individual's coat and say, hey, listen, that wasn't cool. Hey, listen, you're in this community. Why are you referring to this person as a whatever term you want to use for that individual? I've done that plenty of times. That's my reputation. I don't have a problem with letting you know, and it has nothing to do with the tough guy, or it has nothing to do with, hey, listen, you're going to leave my people. It's not even that. It's just basic common sense. You should be able to pull that individual's coat and to let them know, hey, listen, you're going about this the wrong way. You're going about this the wrong way. Please don't let me call you out. You know, and some of us, we just need to be more brave, because it's too much going on, and a lot of this could be stopped on the most fundamental level.
And a lot of this could be stopped on a most fundamental level if we stop the groupthink within policing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that doesn't mean that, hey, listen, you know, you want to be the guy who always says, hey, listen, don't do things. I mean, you know, I'm not saying that. But when something is just blatantly wrong, you see what I'm saying? Because that's where the communities feel a certain type of way, as they say out in the street. I feel a certain type of way. A lot of times when they see that you're going to defend an individual when he's just blatantly wrong, then you're going to lose the confidence of that community. You're going to lose the confidence of that community.
And
once you lose the confidence of that community, you create a situation where it's almost a war.
And we're talking with Investigator McBride, who is part of the U.S. Fugitive Task Force.
The U.S. Marshals Fugitive Task Force that was deployed from the New Jersey Department of Corrections.
And this has been a conversation that we needed to have as a community, to hear it from the side of law enforcement. As they do their job, they know that everyone in the community is not a criminal. They also know that in many times, in instances in which they wade into the community in order to bring out that bad apple, take out that person, not literally, but remove them from the community in order to stand trial, to be punished, that there's a lot of subjectivity. It involves personal interactions. I want to thank you so much, Investigator McBride, for joining us today.
Thank you, Gloria. I appreciate it.
Yes, thank you. And we can also hear more from him on October 27th, because he is one of the panelists, and his panel is Police Perspectives on Community Policing. And I thank you for joining us today at Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall. That panel,
police perspectives on community policing. You will hear more from investigator Ali McBride, Fugitive Task Force, New Jersey Department of Corrections. And he is part of what I think is something that the late Lloyd Seeley said back in 1964 when he told police officers, and primarily 80% of the police force was white, and they were policing Harlem, which at the time was mostly black. And he said, and I quote, "You," meaning police officers, "you try to show the police that this is a community of decent people with the same values and same standards as any other community. People who strongly resent any implication that they don't have these values." So when the community is seen as a community that does not have the same values as those who are policing it, that's when the resentment begins. And with other issues and incidents, it only widens to the point where there is such distrust that we are in need of a conference such as the one launched today, Dividing, Bridging the Divide, Reimagining Police-Community Relations. When we return, it will be with President Jeremy Travis of John Jay College. This is Gloria J. Brown Marshall, Law of the Land, WBAI 99.5 FM. We'll be right back. Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall. Today launches a year-long conference, Bridging the Divide, Reimagining Police Community Relations. This conference is taking place at my college, I like to say, I like to claim it. I work in the Law and Police Science Department there, and I work under the auspices of a president that is one who has a long and deep relationship with working on these issues, criminal justice, with looking at not just the data but the people behind what happens when we have statistics with such a high rate of incarceration, and these now formerly incarcerated people making their way back into society is called reentry. So I am so pleased to have with us today as our final guest, but the guest, of course, who is the leader of John Jay and the one with a vision for this year-long conference, President Jeremy Travis, the fourth president of John Jay College. He was a senior fellow, the Justice Policy Center, the Urban Institute, director of the National Institute of Justice. He has done so much. He is an author on these criminal justice issues, especially around the issue of reentry. Welcome, President Travis.
Well, thank you for the invitation. It's wonderful to be with you.
Well, I know that your time is scarce, and I really am honored that you've joined Law of the Land today. I want to make sure that people understand that this conference is so unique because it is one that starts today and goes on until May 5th and 6th. And so in putting something like this together, we've talked with Tiffany Wheatland and police officer Ali McBride. We've talked with Professor Eli Silverman. But it's your vision here. What do you envision happening with this conference? What do you envision it actually giving our community and our police force?
Well, I think it's useful just to take one step back in the history and to remind ourselves that a year ago and over the past several months, there's been just a lot of public controversy around issues of policing, police use of force, particularly deadly force, relations between the police and communities, particularly black and brown communities, and that these issues came to a head in a very forceful way with demonstrations in the streets and the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement. And in some cases, urban unrest and riots. So the country has been through a very difficult time over the last year, and these historical forces hit our campus. As you'll remember, Gloria, we had students very concerned about what was going on in their communities. Some of our students are police officers. Some of them are aspiring to be police officers. Many of them have other career aspirations, and our campus became a place where these issues came to the fore in a very, very pronounced way. So last spring, as that was happening all around the world and here at John Jay, a number of us put our heads together and asked, what is it that an academic institution should do in response to these pressing issues, many of them issues of very long standing, but that have now come to the fore in a pronounced way. And we decided to launch this initiative. And I want to just thank our colleague, Jama Adams. Professor Adams is the chair of our Africana Studies Department, who chaired the committee that I set up to design this initiative. And today is our launch, and we're launching with, as I'm sure you've already referenced, a keynote speech by Ken Thompson. Our very proud to claim him as an alumnus, the DA in Kings County, who's giving a speech that we're co-sponsoring with NOBLE, the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives. So the initiative is year-long so that we can do lots of things and keep the issue in the forefront of our minds and have different speakers and different types of activities. And as an academic institution, educational institution, for our, particularly our students, but all of us, to really just come to grips with these challenges.
And the vision for the outcome. Now, this is something I know that is very tricky, and you've worked with the data and actually working and understanding the people who are personally affected by criminal justice decisions. And So when we have a conference like this, many people stay on the outside, the community, of course we're talking about police community relations, will say, okay, here's another conference and more people talking. But we know that dialogue is necessary, but we also know that the President of the United States, Barack Obama, yourself, in this initiative, we're all working to try to make it a little bit better. How do you think this conference will do that?
Well, in the first instance, we need to challenge people to think and translate their thoughts into action. So there are a number of initiatives or components of this larger initiative that are action-oriented. Our students are gathering to talk about their experiences with the police and how they want to frame those issues so that they can do work in the community. One of our students who's organizing the event, Edsel Mendoza, is doing work in Brownsville. So he's going to bring that experience of his work in Brownsville into the initiative in the hopes that he will be able to get more students involved. But we're also thinking about this as part of a larger suite of activities underway here at John Jay. So we've had, over the years, we've had forums here on the Stop Question and Frisk debate in the city. We are the home of the National Initiative for Building Community Trust and Justice, funded by the Obama administration here, that's working in six cities around the country on issues of implicit bias and police-community relations. And one of the speakers in our panel will be Tracy Cassie, who's the director of that initiative. So we will bring the experiences of our faculty and students into the college in the hopes that it will prompt a broader discussion that will lead to change at the community level and change in the realm of policing.
And we also have, as our U.S. Attorney General now, our own Loretta Lynch.
Yeah, indeed. She is ours.
Yes, she is ours, yeah. Indeed. Yeah. And she's spoken at the college many times. We're in this conference, which is open to the public and free. The role of community is also very important. How do you envision their role in this conference?
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned that, because this is open and people can find it on our website. We do encourage people to come, and some of them require registration, so please register in advance. We are a public institution. Our students are, most of them, from New York City's neighborhoods, so we want them and their parents and their peers and their community members to feel that this is a welcoming environment to come and participate in these discussions. And in some cases, particularly you referenced the ending event in May, will be a big forum on police-youth relationships in particular, and we'll have young people here talking about their relations with the police. So we do want this to be seen as something that's not in the proverbial ivory tower, but is actually very much related to the work underway in communities. And we are a College of Criminal Justice, and many of our alumni go on to work in law enforcement. So this is not a one-sided conversation. This is a rich conversation. And hence the subtitle to the initiative is Reimagining Police-Community Relations. We really want to engage people across the divide in thinking differently about how both parties, community and law enforcement, the policing, can, as our commissioner has said, Police Commissioner Bratton says, see each other. How can we sort of talk to each other differently? How can we understand each other's perspectives differently? How can we be engaged in constructive action that will change policing for the better and create a new dynamic at community level? So we have lots of big topics we'll be talking about, different perspectives, and we do encourage people to check it out and come participate.
And you're listening to President Jeremy Travis of John Jay College. He will be giving introductory notes to our audience tonight, the Lloyd George Seeley Lecture. the 25th anniversary of this lecture tonight at 6 p.m. at John Jay College. Having the district attorney here and knowing that there's been a great deal of controversy around the role of the DA and in policing and these very hot button issues, looking at it from your perspective, president of a College of Criminal Justice, having worked in so many different issues involving criminal justice, when you're talking to our audience, what do you want them to know? What is the takeaway when it comes to criminal justice and the future that you would want them to rely on, to believe in, to gain that trust?
Well, let me start, Gloria, as you did, with the importance of the district attorney as a role in our criminal justice system. So we're maybe the only country in the world that elects its prosecutors. So that means that we who vote for people who hold that office have a responsibility to hold them accountable. And we have, as our speaker tonight, and we're honored that he's going to be joining us, Ken Thompson from Brooklyn, who is, I think, one of the emerging national leaders of a new generation of DAs who are thinking very carefully about what is the role of the DA in promoting safety and at the same time promoting justice, particularly in the era of mass incarceration and particularly in the era of, you know, deeply embedded problems of violence at a community level, where we haven't figured out how to produce the next level of public safety. So DAs, whom we elect, are critical leaders in the next era of criminal justice reform. As you alluded to before, my particular recent scholarly work has been on the issue of mass incarceration. And the voice of DAs is an important voice on helping the country figure out how to reduce our reliance on prison, not simply keep putting people in prison. And this is a discussion that I've had with Mr. Thompson and others, and it's interesting to see how they are now coming to embrace that challenge. But they also have a role, I think, in the work of policing and the issues of race. And Ken Thompson has been quite explicit about, given his own history in New York, he's a son of a police officer, grew up in public housing, has come to John Jay, then to NYU. So he has a particular personal connection to these issues. He takes that part of his responsibility as an elected official very seriously. And he talks movingly about campaigning for this office and having people say to him, we want to live in safety. So the DA can be an important part of our democracy in thinking about the challenges that we face and how we move out of particularly mass incarceration, but move into a new era of relationships between the police and communities of color.
And we're talking with, we've been honored to have, President Jeremy Travis of John Jay College, author, expert in the area of criminal justice, one whom the administration has relied on to help us ferret out how we can have a fairer and more equitable criminal justice system. I thank you so much for being with us today, and I hope the community looks forward to and will join you tonight at 6 o'clock on campus to hear the Lloyd Seeley Lecture given by Brooklyn DA Thompson. Thank you again.
Well, thank you. My pleasure.
This is Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall. We just had a great, insightful talk by my president, Jeremy Travis at John Jay College. And we need to understand that what we're putting forward, we being the collective we, because we had Professor Tiffany Wheatland on earlier talking about coordinating this conference with professors at the college who are doing an outstanding job in giving you, the community, a year-long conference. And when I say the community, I say the community writ large. We want those people in academia in the tri-state area to attend. We want people who have an interest in criminal justice to attend. We want law enforcement and those within any aspect of law enforcement, educators, all those people who have this sense that we can do a better job.
we can do better than this when it comes to policing our communities. We had Dr. Eli Silverman say there are police officers who are saying we can do better than this, that the pressure on them is immense. And they know when there is something fair going on, and they know when it's unfair. And there are many within those ranks, as we've heard from Investigator Ali McBride, who want to step up, who want to do better. Others who have a sense can give a nudge to those other officers and say, better understand the community. We have the history of Lloyd Seeley, who has said those people in the community have the values of those who are policing them. All of this and more will be discussed over this year, this conference that will take place on the campus of John Jay College, 59th and 10th Avenue, Bridging the Divide, Reimagining Police-Community Relations, begins this evening, goes on until May. I thank you so much for joining Law of the Land today. My engineer is Michael G. Haskins. I'm the executive producer. My Twitter account, if you want to follow me on Twitter, my hashtag, G. Brown Marshall. You can read my articles online. See you on the radio.
Dragonfly out in the sun, you know what I mean, don't you know? Butterflies all having fun, you know what I mean? Sleep in peace when day is done, that's what I mean. And this old world is a new world and a bold world for me. Shine, you know how I feel. Send out the pine, you know how I feel.
Gloria J. Brown Marshall here on Law of the Land. Law of the Land, Tuesday mornings at 10 a.m. Gloria J. Brown Marshall, Associate Professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. She's the author of Race, Law and American Society, 1607 to Present, The Constitution in African American Context, and The Constitution, Major Cases and Conflicts. Bridging the Divide, Reimagining Police and Community Relations. Just visit the John Jay College website for more information. All right, coming up at noon will be The Gary Null Show. And once again, you are tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI, and visit us online at WBAI.org on the web.
The following is a statement from a WBAI local station board candidate. The views expressed are not those of WBAI management, staff, or current board. To view full candidate statements, visit www.elections.pacifica.org.
Hi, I'm James Sagerton, running for the local station board. As a WBAI volunteer and member of both the Finance Committee and the Community Advisory Board, I've seen firsthand what's up. Membership and donations are down. We're not reaching young people on the internet. We've lost millions in grants because one faction-run sister station hasn't completed required audits for years. Now, a new leasing agent for the Empire State Building seems unwilling to finish renegotiating our high antenna rent. So proposals to sell, swap, or lease our signal are flying around without any transparency for the listeners. I'll work with anyone to save WBAI, but the candidates I've seen doing the most to fix it are with the Elect Indy Caucus 2015. Vote James Sagerton. Vote Indy.
Warm greetings to BAI members. Mi más cordiales saludos a todos. I'm Dacio Quintana, running for the board with the Justice and Unity Campaign, endorsed by Pro Libertad and others, because we must strengthen this precious resource. I'm a retired teacher who's organized for years around social justice issues. I volunteer with the group Strategies for Social Change. At BAI, I've witnessed mismanagement and nastiness that have weakened the station. We need to implement a diversified fundraising plan using detailed proposals by Justice and Unity and others. We need more programming that conveys the activism of youth and our diverse communities. Please vote for the entire Justice and Unity slate. Visit justiceunity.org.
Stop members of the Pacifica National Board from selling WBAI. Pacifica and WBAI have lost more than $2 million because of the same board member's appointment of a CFO who failed to submit an audit. My name is Alex Steinberg. Years ago, I was a highly effective member of the Pacifica National Board. I know where the bodies are buried. I am running again so we could save WBAI and the Pacifica Network. Only the Indy Elect Caucus 2015 candidates are pledged to change the National Board and management and save WBAI. If you want accountability, financial stability, progressive programming, and an end to cronyism, vote for me, Alex Steinberg. For more information, go to electindycaucus2015.org.
Hello, WBAI. My name is Bob Young, and I am an independent caucus member running for re-election as a listener candidate on the local station board. For the past 3 years, I have served the listeners faithfully as chair and as vice chair with an almost perfect attendance record. The LSB is only empowered to certain tasks by the bylaws. I pledge to support them and not make false promises about what can and cannot be done. I support transparency and accountability in Pacifica and in WBAI. Please vote for me, Bob Young, and the whole Elect Indy Caucus 2015 team. Visit us at www.electindycaucus2015.org. And at our Facebook page by the same name. Thank you.
The views expressed are not those of WBAI management, staff, or current board. To view full candidate statements, visit www.elections.pacifica.org.
The West Harlem Art Fund, in partnership with Pratt Digital Media, will present four new digital artworks entitled Under the Viaduct on 125th Street and 12th Avenue on Saturday, October 3rd. Celebrate the fall in white light after dark. It will start at 6 p.m. Art, play, ride, and dine. For more information, go to undertheviaduct.wordpress.com.
We're the New Orleans Jazz Vipers at WBAI, New York City.
Hi, this is Gil Scott here, an unknown bluesologist, speaking to you on Free Speech Radio, WBAI 99.5 on your radio dial. Stay here.